One of the most persistent, persisting images carried about us as a people is that of the wandering Jew. Presumably, we are not given to settling down and settling in. Now, most of the associations of this image are unflattering. Presumably, we have the wanderlust. Presumably, because we are always thinking of moving on, we cannot be trusted to be loyal to a particular place or a particular government. And the origins of this image are, of course, in early Christianity. And the basis of this charge is theological and, of course, not historic. The early Christians had the problem of emerging as a community in the Roman world. Being a missionary faith, they were eager to convert their world. And clearly, if they charged the Romans with the crime of deicide, with the crucifixion, they would establish the Romans as the enemy, those who conspired against God, and they would be in a very difficult position in terms of their approach and their appeal. And so one can trace in the documents and the traditions which ultimately comprise the New Testament and the early church literature a growing tendency to shift the blame for the crucifixion from Pontius Pilate and the Romans to the Jews, to Jerusalem, to the Pharisees, to the Jews of the day. Now, even a theological assumption must have some seeming proof. And early Christians found their proof for this change in the fact that the temple was destroyed in the year 70, some 40 years after the crucifixion. God, according to their theology, clearly was indicating that he was punishing the Jews and scattering them across the face of the earth. Now, the fact that the diaspora, the scattering of Jewish communities, had already taken place over the last 7 or 8 centuries did not particularly bother them. Theology rarely is too narrowly concerned with facticity. On the other hand, they looked in Scripture, and they found that the mark of Cain, the God's punishment of Cain for the killing of Abel, was to curse him, to declare him a pariah, and to condemn him to be Navanad Ba'aretz, an endless, restless wanderer across the face of the earth. Cain and Abel, you recall, were the two sons of Adam and Eve. They're presented to us in the book of Genesis as if they are the prototypes of the herdsman and of the farmer. Cain is the man who is the shepherd, the herdsman, who wants the open range. Abel is the farmer, the settled person. The farmer requires fences to keep the cattle from trotting on his fields. And this whole eternal conflict, which we saw again in our West not so many generations ago, between the ranchers and the farmers, between the herdsmen and the farmers of ancient times, is typified and mythologized in Scripture as the fact that both these two young men offer a sacrifice to God competitively. God accepts the sacrifice of the farmer of Abel. Cain is so outraged by the ultimate victory of the farmer, as the farmer, in fact, becomes the ultimate victor, that he slays Abel and is condemned to be this, to wear the mark of Cain and to be an endless wanderer across the face of the earth. And so the image of the wandering Jew harks back to the image of Cain, to someone who is cursed and condemned by God. And it's not surprising that these associations should be largely negative in the minds of at least the Western world. But as is true with almost any powerful and popular image, Jews too began to accept the idea of the people, our people, as a wandering people. Now, of course, we didn't give the same explanation for it. But I remember back in my confirmation days here that we had to memorize a whole series of dates. And after the dates which had to do with biblical times, there was the year 70, the destruction of the temple. There was the year 132, 135, the failed Bar Kokhba revolt against Rome, which led to defeat and dispersion again. the year 1290 when the Jews were exiled from England, the year 1391 when the Jews were exiled from France, the year 1492 when the Jews were exiled from Spain. Some of you may remember having to memorize those dates. But we were left with the impression that Jews had spent their time being pushed from pillar to post by a cruel world. It was not that we had the wanderlust, but that we weren't allowed to settle in, that there were always a series of exiles and pogroms and attacks and expulsions, and that we were in fact a wandering people. And there seemed to be some basis of confirmation of this in our own immediate experience, because Jews have been uniquely prone to that disease called upward mobility in the United States, from the East Side to Harlem to Brooklyn to Forest Hills to the Five Towns to Scarsdale, from East 40th Street to Glenville to Cleveland Heights to Shaker Heights to Pepper Pike and Pike, and then across the river. And so we saw people picking up their institutions, picking up their homes, and moving twice, three times in a generation. And perhaps we came to believe that, in fact, there was some kind of a wanderlust in our souls. Now, the confirmation which the Christian world found for its interpretation of this image was drawn largely from our liturgy, a liturgy in which time and again we hope that we will be returned to Zion. And they said, how can one trust a people, though they live among us, who always sang L'shana haba'ah b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, who really are not willing to set down roots to identify their fate and their future with us? What they did not say is that this image is a messianic one. That is to say, it was what would happen at the end of times when God would interfere in the affairs of the world, and that during the long centuries after the destruction of the temple, Jews took remarkably little, made remarkably few efforts to reestablish communities, a settlement sovereignty in the Holy Land. The point of fact, as you know, during the early decades of Zionism, of modern Zionism, it was the most orthodox and traditional of the communities who were most opposed to the Zionist movement, because they said, Ein mekaf feitz bakeitz, you don't force the end. We're to await for the Messiah to do this task, and not to try to do it on our own. And they found in Scripture the confirmation of what is really the agenda of Jews whenever they are allowed to settle in. It appears in the scroll of Jeremiah. In the year 597 before the Common Era, the Babylonians, under one of their great generals, Nebuchadnezzar, came east from the Mesopotamia area and conquered the lands of Syria and of Palestine, and lay siege to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem surrendered. And a large proportion of the nobility of Jerusalem was taken captive. Jeremiah remained in Jerusalem. And on God's command, he sent a letter to the captives, setting out God's will for how they were to act in their dispersion. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, unto all the captivity whom I have caused to be carried away captive from Jerusalem unto Babylon. Build ye houses, and dwell in them, plant gardens, and eat the fruit of them. Take wives, and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, and multiply you there, be you not diminished. Seek the peace of the country wherein I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray unto the Lord for it, for in the peace thereof shall you have peace. And then Jeremiah repeats an oracle of God that in 70 years this dispersion will be ended by God's action and the people will be returned to Zion. We are a people who have wanted to settle in, have felt that God, to a very large degree, wanted us to settle in, and whenever we were given a chance, we in fact did set down roots. David conquered the city of Jerusalem around the year 1000 before the Common Era. And there has been an almost constant settlement by Jews in that city ever since, nearly 3,000 years. When one of the generals of Alexander the Great was given the governorship of Egypt, he decided to establish a new capital. He called it Alexandria. The year is 330 before the Common Era. He brought down from Judea a group of Jews to be the craftsmen, the carpenters, the builders, the bricklayers for his new city. And from that day to this, there has been a continuous settlement by Jews in Alexandria, nearly 2,400 years. Jews have lived in Rome without cease since the second century before the Common Era. Wherever we have been allowed to settle in, we have settled down. When you think of the fact that the great cities of Northern Europe are really few of them 1,000 years old, you recognize how long, in fact, 1,000 years of a settlement in a particular community really is. 40 to 50 generations of Jews living one after another in cities such as this. And I thought I would illustrate this theme of the non-wandering Jew this week and in a few weeks in a series which will run for several weeks by telling you the history of a number of cities in which Jews have lived for a considerable period of time, for over 1,000 years. I begin with Cairo. I could use Alexandria. Jews have lived in Alexandria much longer than they lived in Cairo, for Cairo is a newer city. But the great days of Alexandria were during Greco-Roman times, and the great days of Cairo came after the Muslims conquered Egypt in 641 of the Common Era. It was at that time that Cairo became the administrative capital of Egypt. And because, as you shall see, there's a very particular evidence of continuity within the history of Cairo itself. Cairo sits at the point at which the Nile, about 10, 15 miles before the Nile, begins to bifurcate into the great delta, which runs northward from Cairo to the Mediterranean. It's at the end of the point where it's easy for the great dhows, which bring the cargo up and down the Nile, to travel. You have to travel by caravan or by smaller boat from about that point. And so it always has been a great center for the transport and for the movement of goods. The early, in pharaonic times, second millennium, the first millennium before the Common Era, the northern capital of Egypt tended to be at a place called Memphis, which is today about 3 miles south of Cairo on the west bank of the Nile River. During Greco-Roman times, the administrative center moved to the coast because the Romans and the Byzantines used the Mediterranean for their major means of communication and administration. But when in 640, the armies of Muhammad under Amr moved into Egypt and conquered Egypt and took it from the Byzantines, they were much more of a landlocked people, much more used to caravan travel than to sea travel. And they returned the capital, the administrative center of Egypt, to the Cairo area. Indeed, the original name of Cairo in Muslim time was Al-Fushtat. Fushtat means the tent. And the tent, the general headquarters where Amr pitched his tent during the siege of a small Byzantine fortress, which was in the area called Babylon, marks the place where Fushtat, old Cairo, was first settled, where the walls were first built. We know very little about this small Byzantine fortress, Babylon. It's doubtful the Jews lived there. The Byzantines, particularly in the 4th and 5th century, made life very difficult for Jews. But we do know that almost immediately after the conquest of Egypt and of this area by the Muslims, Jews moved to from the villages of Egypt, from Alexandria to Cairo to the administrative center, and a Jewish quarter existed in Fushtat almost from the beginning. Now, the Jews tended to prosper in these early Muslim days. The other major minority in Egypt among the natives were the Copts, and the Copts were Christian. And the great enemy of the Muslims was the Byzantine Empire, a Christian empire. And so it was the Copts who were suspected of dual loyalties, of being subversive rather than the Jewish minority. And during these early years, after the amazing spread of Islam, which took in a century, really began to encompass the known world, a set of victories which drained Muslim manpower and spread it thin, there was great need for people of skill, trained in commerce, trained in the bureaucracies, trained in administration, and the Muslims made good use of Jews during those early days. One of the earliest documents about the Jews of Cairo is not from the Jewish community, but from the Coptic community. It's dated 882 of the Common Era. It's a report that the Sultan had ordered the Coptic Patriarch to turn over to the Jewish community one of the Coptic churches in Fustat for use as a synagogue. And interestingly, this was done, and this synagogue exists to this day. And when we think of Cleveland, and think of the movements of the congregations in Cleveland in just the 150, 160 year history of our Jewish community, and then think of a synagogue which has existed not only in the same city as a congregation, but in the same location for over 1,000 years. You can visit this synagogue today. One recognizes what stability, settling in, is really all about. The synagogue is called today the Ezra Synagogue. It's in the old city, Fustat. It's in an area that you have to walk down into because the level of the present city is about 20 feet above the level of the buildings in the oldest part of Fustat, which are now being refurbished as a kind of tourist center. And the reason we know that this building existed in the same place, so obviously it was refurbished and the walls were rebuilt and it was changed from time to time, is that we have records, a great number of records, which come from this synagogue. I don't know how many of you remember, as I do, an old radio program in the United States, which was called Fibber McGee and Molly. Remember it? But whenever the writers of Fibber McGee and Molly didn't know how to fill up a little bit of airtime, they would have Fibber go to a closet, and he would open the door of the closet. You remember this? And everything in the closet would then cascade down on the floor. Everything had been pitched in, and everything would then fall out, and everybody would get a good laugh, and then they'd have a transition to the next scene. Well, there was a Fibber McGee and Molly closet in the Ezra Synagogue in Cairo. It was called the Geniza. The Geniza means a treasury, a place where things are set aside. To understand the Geniza, I'll take you back a bit. When Jews began to center Judaism on a Torah, on a script, that script was deemed to be holy, but the name of God in the script was the most holy of all. There was something of the divine in God's own name. And we know now that some of the very early Torah scrolls found in among the Dead Sea community scrolls were written in the New Hebrew, which is the Hebrew which we write our scrolls in. But whenever they came to Adonai, they wrote it in the what we call Proto-Hebrew, Lashon Ivrit, which looks much more like cuneiform than the script with which you're familiar, and was the script used by Jews from about the 10th century and 11th century before the Common Era down to the Babylonian exile. And later on, the custom seems to develop in certain scrolls to write the name Adonai of God, the four letters of God's name, not simply in this old script, but to write it in the new script, but to do it in gold letters. Something of the divine, of the power, of the sacredness of God was reflected in his name. And so the custom grew in our communities not to dispose carelessly of any document which included the name of God. And what they began to do in Talmudic times, whenever they had a scroll or documents which included God's name, they would carefully collect these until they had a sufficient number, and then they would bury these with the same dignity with which a human being would be buried. The human being is created in the image of God. The name of God is something of his image. And so these documents required proper burial. And one of the meanings behind Geniza has to do with burial. Now the Geniza came to include not only documents that included the name of God, but many other documents which were important to this Jewish community. And how that change took place, we're not quite sure. But we do know that from at least the year 950 of the Common Era until the 1880s, Jews from Cairo, from Fustat, would bring to this, what was a lumber room, a closet in the old synagogue, and they would toss into the room letters, manuscripts, old books, scrolls, documents of various kinds, until there was veritably a mountain of parchment, a mountain of paper in this room, higgly-piggly, that is, it was not in archives. It was never arranged. It was never systematized. You went and you tossed, and wherever it fell, it fell. And not only was it not systematized, there was no librarian, guardian at the door, but whenever Jews needed some paper, they would go into the archives, to the Geniza, and they would try and find a document which hadn't had any writing on the back or the margins hadn't been used, and they would cut it off, and they would use this margin or the back for some other document. Paper, parchment was very, very expensive. We didn't have the kinds of cheap writing materials that we have today. And so you very often find a document which on the front of it has to do with the commerce, for instance, in the 12th century of spices from Cochin in India to Cairo, what was being paid, the transportation costs and the like. And on the side you may find a penmanship exercise for some child in a school. And on the back, a scribe may have written out a marriage contract or a get, a bill of divorcement or something of this kind. Now, this Geniza was never lost. It was constantly in use. But few recognize the historic importance of this find, of this great mound of materials, until Jews became interested in their own history in the middle of the 19th century. The first person who seems to have decided about the value of much of the material was a strange Jew, a Karaite, that is, a member of a small community from Russia, who believed that the Talmud had no authority, only the Bible had authority over Jewish life, a man named Firkovich, who went down in the 1860s to Cairo, somehow gave a few dinars to the shamus of the shul, was allowed into the Geniza, stuffed his luggage full of documents, took them back to Russia, and they now survive in Russia in the State Museum, the State Library of Leningrad. And the problem, of course, is that few people have access now to these documents when we're really capable fully of studying them. And once Firkovich came down, the bazaar keepers and merchants of Cairo are no slouches. They recognized that others might be interested in this material. And suddenly, materials became available on the open market. You could go to a bazaar in the 1870s or 1880s in Cairo and be offered parchment from the Geniza of one kind or another. And many a Jewish traveler was induced to buy one of these documents, and that's how we got our Geniza fragment, which I'll explain to you in a minute. And there are those fragments of this kind around the country. But a number of scholars also came, and major bundles of these documents found their way through these scholars' good graces to the Dropsy College in Philadelphia, to the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and to Oxford. And then in 1895, the man who was the reader in rabbinics at Cambridge University, Shalman Schechter, who later became the first provost of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, had brought to him by two women who were amateur Orientalists who loved to travel in the Middle East and knew some Arabic, a number of pages which they had bought in the bazaar in Cairo. And they asked Schechter to identify their purchase. And looking through these documents, he recognized that one page was the Hebrew original of a commonplace book written by a teacher in Jerusalem by the name of Ben Sirach in the second century before the Common Era. The Wisdom of Ben Sirach, or Ecclesiasticus, had come down from ancient times in a Greek translation. So we knew that they knew the text and we knew what the text should be. But no one had ever found the Hebrew original, and here suddenly appearing in front of Salman Schechter was a page from one of the chapters of this important book. And later on, the scholars were able to find from these various collections of the Geniza almost an entire copy of the Wisdom of Ben Sirach in Hebrew. Well, Schechter recognized then the true importance of this find. He went to the master of St. John's College at Cambridge. He received from this man enough money to go to Cairo and to buy all the remaining manuscripts from the Geniza, which he brought back with him to Cambridge, where they remain to this day. Cambridge, therefore, has about three times as many documents of the Geniza as the rest of the collections put together. And it is there that the major research in the Geniza takes place. So we have a record of a single synagogue and of the activities of the people who were around that synagogue since the 10th century, perhaps earlier. And we have a rather constant record, which is fascinating because it's not the record only of the elite, only of the scholarly, only of religious themes. Most of the documents are quite personal, private letters, bills of lading, shipping instructions, deeds for the purchase of a house, documents like this one. What you see in this frame, and the frame is a bazaar frame, it's not a Geniza frame, is the top half of a ketubah, of a marriage contract, which was found in the Geniza We don't know the history of how it found its way from Cairo to Cleveland, but it did. And it is dated the year 1553. It's the marriage contract of a certain man named Simon and a certain girl named Miriam. It is an Egyptian ketubah. That is not something that was brought by a family to Egypt, but it was written there. Our historians will tell us that we have the best half of the ketubah because the major part, the text, most of it is missing. Because we can get a sense of the shape of the document, the roundel and the triangular lines which form the top as if it were the top of an envelope are filled with lovely phrases wishing the bride and the groom well. You have just the beginning of the text, and the text leaves off just at the point where historians would find it interesting. That is to say, we're not told what the dowry was. We're not told what the marriage price that the groom paid to the bride's family. We're not told anything about the terms of the marriage contract, and that would give us some personal history. It gives some indication of the values of goods and services at that particular period in time. But it's a very beautifully shaped document, and we're delighted to have it as an example of the materials from this place. Now, it's not surprising that this ketubah is cut in half. Almost all the ketubot, which were found in the Gniz, and there are several hundred of them, some go back to the 11th century, have been cut in just this way. And what we've discovered is that there was a custom in Cairo that when the ketubah was no longer in effect, which means that the woman or her family placed this ketubah in the Gniza either after she was widowed or after divorce, which is to say that the ketubah contained stipulations of what was brought into the marriage. And it also contained a stipulation which said that upon divorce or widowhood, the following values must be returned to the woman. This was her possession. And so to indicate that the document was no longer in force, that they had completed the exchange of the goods, either upon widowhood or upon divorce, they would cut the document in half and they would place it in the Gniza because it was no longer in effect. Gniza, in other words, received documents which were no longer valid, no longer in effect, rather than those which were still valid, which were kept by families themselves. Now, what do we learn from the Gniza? We learn from the Gniza that Jewish life thrived in Fashtat until about the late 12th, early 13th century. Fashtat, during those years, remained largely the capital of Egypt. However, around the end of the 10th, the beginning of the 11th century, the Fatimid emperors built a new capital 2 miles to the north, which they called Cairo. And the palace moved there, and that was the beginning of the slow subsidence of Fashtat, which became more and more a working class, lower class suburb, rather than the center of economic and political life as it had once been. And Jewish life followed the general pattern of the community. The richer Jews moved to Cairo, and the poorer Jews remained around the Ezra synagogue in Fashtat. Jewish life thrived, as did Muslim life generally, during the first 3 or 4 centuries of the Muslim conquest. These were times of great prosperity for the community as large. There was a great deal of international trade. All the trade from North Africa, from the Levant, and from India, one way or another, passed through Cairo. We find Jews who were international merchants, and we find Jews who were peddlers, artisans, simple shopkeepers, all coexisting in a single community. This particular synagogue was what they called Minhag Yerushalmi. It followed the customs of the academy which governed in Jerusalem. There was another synagogue in Fashtat which was the Minhag Bavli, which followed the customs of the Babylonian community, the Babylonian Talmud. Later on, there was another synagogue in the community which was Sephardic, which had the traditions of the Jews of Spain. Later on, there was an Ashkenazic community which followed the customs of the Jews of Europe. And as one would assume in a Jewish community, there were a number of arguments of one kind or another between all of these synagogues and even within the synagogue. But what we hear is that there were extortionist taxes imposed upon these communities, that they depended upon the whims of the governing body, the Muslims, and they existed only on tolerance, that even the most powerful could be destroyed by the will of the Sultan, the Caliph, or his agents. We learn, however, that there were few actual physical attacks on this community until after the year 1250. In the year 1250, a group of Janissaries, of mercenaries, overthrew the Fatimid Empire emperors and took over the governance of Egypt. Simple men, mostly illiterate men and fanatics in their own way. They came to power at a time when there was less and less prosperity in Islam generally, and when the Muslim world was breaking up into a series of provincial centers. The ability to goods to pass easily from place to place was radically diminished. And the Jewish community then began to suffer any number of indignities and physical attacks. And later on, these continued under the Ottoman Turks. We have a number of documents which tell us some interesting things about this community. We think of funerals in our time as daytime events. For most of the Middle Ages, funerals took place in Cairo at midnight. Why? The documents make it clear that the rabbis organized the funerals at that time of the night because that was the time at which they could count on Muslims being in bed. When the funeral processions went through the crowded streets of Fashhad or Cairo during the daytime, they would be pelted with stones. People would throw garbage from the windows down on them. In order to maintain the dignity and the decorum of the procession and of the funeral itself, they devised that either they would be accompanied through the street by armed men who would protect them, or they would move the funerals to midnight when the streets would be empty and they would be able to go on their way unmolested, which gives you a sense of the tensions which life in Egypt and Fashhad and Cairo underwent during that period of time. Cairo also had its own very special Purim. Purim, you know, celebrates the deliverance of the Jews from an edict of genocide. In the year 1525, a sultan named Ahmed demanded of the Jews a sum of money on pain of genocide, which they couldn't possibly come up with. And he stipulated, like Haman did, a certain day, which if the money was not forthcoming, all the Jews would be imprisoned and ultimately killed. And strange to behold, and God works in strange and mysterious ways, the Cairanese would say, on the very day that they were to bring this money, which they didn't have to prove that they were to the Ahmed, a palace coup took place. Ahmed was assassinated. And ever since the 7th of Adar, the Purim de Mitzrayim, the Purim of Egypt, has been celebrated as an annual event by the more traditional Jews as a time of deliverance from this kind of extortion. This was the most dramatic of the pressures and the challenges where this community had to meet, and there were, believe me, many others. Interestingly, Cairo, for all of its early wealth, and despite the fact that any number of important Jewish scholars from time to time were attracted to Cairo and lived there, Maimonides lived there, for instance, during the last 30 years of his life, Cairo never seems to have developed an indigenous scholar group. By and large, it drew its rabbinic leadership from people who were trained elsewhere, at Antioch and Istanbul and Jerusalem and Baghdad and Damascus and Fez. Few of the great leaders of Cairo were native born. And Cairo was not a place which developed the great yeshivot, the great academic centers of Jewish life. It was a mercantile place. It was a place which where Jews made a living. And it was the place from which the rest of Egypt was administered Jewishly and organized under the leadership of a man known as the Nasi, the prince, the head. Maimonides was given that title, and after him for five generations, his son and grandson, great-grandson. It passed around from family to family, but there was always a single person who represented the Jews to the court and who represented the court to the Jewish community. Life went on in a rather undramatic but difficult fashion during the late Middle Ages until the 19th century. As the 19th century dawns, there's a Jewish community of perhaps 20 to 25,000 souls in all of Egypt. Numbers in Egypt were generally not that large. And then the colonial powers, first France and then England, begin to assert their authority. And in order to allow their colonials the freedom to do business in these strange parts of the world, they organized extra-legal, extraterritorial authority for their group. It's called the era of the capitularies. The capitularies were treaties which were entered into by whoever was ruling Egypt and the French and the Germans and the English and the Austrians and so on, which allowed those who carried a particular passport to be exempt from Egyptian law, not to be subject to Egyptian imprisonment, to move freely throughout the land, not to have to deal with Egyptian custom duties. In other words, to be under the law of their colonial, of the colonial power of which they were citizens, rather than under Egyptian law. And the Jewish community of Egypt quickly discovered the great advantage of this kind of arrangement for them. In Egypt, they existed on tolerance. In Egypt, they were a persecuted minority. But if they could claim to be Frenchmen or British or Germans or Austrians, then they suddenly had a freedom of movement, a freedom to do business that they had not had before. And so, several things developed at the same time. A great interest among these families, particularly among those who were most able to do so, to send their sons to Europe to get a European education, to become fluent in the language of the new masters in order to do business. And secondly, the Egyptian Jews suddenly discovered old, old ancestors. If you could prove that you came from India, from the Raj, you could claim British citizenship. If you can prove that your family came from Algeria, you could claim French citizenship. And so there was a very big business in genealogy, in proving that, in fact, you were a French citizen or an Austrian citizen or an English citizen. The English were the toughest, by the way, in order to gain these kinds of rights. And by the end of the 19th century, the Jewish community of Egypt had doubled in size, perhaps tripled in size, and at least half of that community no longer claimed to be Egyptian nationals, but claimed to be the nationals of some European country. And this had served them well. They had become much more westernized, they had become much more wealthy, they had become much more a part of the world. But of course, in the 20th century, where colonialism was replaced by nationalism, this tendency of the Jews to move into the citizenship, or to claim citizenship in some European power, caused them to seem different from, I suspect it would have happened in any case, but separate from, indifferent to, the nationalism of the Egyptians, and that no longer served them well. And you find increasingly in the 20th century that the Jews of Egypt tend to try and move back into Egyptian nationalism, into Egyptian nationality, and to become much more a part of the country. They continued to thrive as westernization moved into and began to develop the infrastructure of the Egyptian economy until the 1930s and 1940s, particularly the 1940s. Egyptian nationalism stood to a very large degree opposed to the Allied interests. Many of the leaders who were nationalist leaders were indifferent to an Allied victory, even though Egypt was a great base for the British forces. And the Jews who found themselves suddenly caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. Movements were afoot to create in Palestine a Jewish national home. The Egyptians were saying, you're not one of us. And at the same time that they are opposed to the creation of a Jewish national home. And so the Jews of Egypt were caught in a very difficult position. Two-thirds of these Jews now lived in Cairo. And by and large, they tried to walk a very thin line between their lives as Cairanese or Egyptians and their lives as Jews. But with the proclamation of the partition resolution in 1947, a series of attacks took place against the Jewish community in Cairo and elsewhere. Property was expropriated. Life was made very unpleasant. During the 1956 war, it became even more difficult when Nasser had already come to power. When Nasser came to power, there was a major expropriation of Jewish institutions and of Jewish monies. There was an expulsion of Jews from Egypt. And again, in the 60s, the pressures on those few who remained worsened, so that a community which may have numbered 75 or 80,000 in all of Egypt, of whom two-thirds lived in Cairo in 1940, by the 1970s numbered only several hundred, and that's about the number that exists there today, this, except for people who may be there as representatives of one government or another. But there are only several hundred Jews who remain as Jews and as Egyptians in Cairo itself. You can visit the Ezra Synagogue. We have. It's today furbished as if it were a 19th century European synagogue. The shamus is a Muslim. who knows absolutely nothing about Jewish customs or Jewish practices. He's filled with tall stories. He took us to the back of the shul and down a set of stairs. We came to a dank place where there was obviously a mikveh, a pool of stagnant water. And he kept saying, Musa, Musa, Moses, Moses, as if this was the place in the Nile where Pharaoh's daughter had found the young Moses in his cradle on the top of the flood. But it's the same place. And there's a sense of history there. Of course, it's in your imagination to a large degree, but it's very real. What's the future of this community? In the short term, certainly very little. Despite the Sadat and Begin's arrangements at Camp David, Egyptian-Jewish relationships, Egyptian-Israeli relationships have been rather studied, and particularly from the Egyptian side, rather cold. Many of us have visited Cairo and or Alexandria, other parts of Egypt. Some Israelis can now travel, but it's still a, if not a cold war, at least there's a great deal of distance and uncertainty. But I suspect that the Jewish community will make an attempt to reestablish itself in Egypt if, and this is the very large if there is a reason to do so. And that reason would have to be an economic one. And at this moment in time, Egypt does not look to be a very good gamble in terms of prosperity. Cairo must originally have been a very lovely city. It sits on the east bank of the Nile. Today it spreads over both sides of the Nile. To the east are tall mountains. To the west is the beginning of the, beyond the Sone is the beginning of the great Libyan desert. And you see spotted there the great pyramids of Giza. But today, a city which at the turn of the century numbered perhaps 500,000 may number as much as 9 to 10 million people. No one's quite sure of the size of Cairo. Cairo is a sprawl. It's an urban mess. It's filled with traffic which doesn't move. The sidewalks are not large enough to accommodate all of the pedestrians. There's not enough housing in the city to accommodate two-thirds of the people most of the people who live there. It's overcrowded. And if you want to see the population explosion and its costs, you have only to see what's happening to Cairo today. There are 44 to 46 million people in Egypt today, a country which had less than 15 million just 25 years ago. Every 10 months, another million people are being added to the population. The countryside cannot support them. They come to the cities cannot support them. And one has a sense of implosion, of civilization destroying itself. So that's a situation that has absolutely nothing to do with the Jews of Cairo, but it certainly has to do with the Jews ever coming back and reestablishing their community in that place. But the ties are strong. Most of the Jews who were of the middle and upper middle class of Egypt who came out in the last 30 or 40 years went to Europe or to the United States rather than to Israel. The poorer Jews went to Israel, the more educated, more cultivated, went to Europe or have come here. Their ties are largely now with the communities in which they live, as they should be. So it's unlikely that there is any pressure, emotional pressure among them to return and reestablish their roots, rediscover their past in the sense of actually living that past again. But the history is rich. And history is full, and I'm delighted that we have in our museum a document which illustrates so beautifully, so effectively, the 1,000 years and more the Jews lived in Cairo. May we live as long in Cleveland. Amen.